Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. Last Friday, the U.S. Senate confirmed Scott Pruitt as the new EPA administrator. This is a man who denies climate change is real. As the Attorney General of Oklahoma, he sued the EPA 14 times while using talking points written by energy lobbyists to publicly attack Obama's Clean Power Plan. Now as head of EPA, he's planning to dismantle the very agency he leads. What will the outlook for energy and climate policy look like under the new administration? This morning, we talk with Tyson Slocum, director of Public Citizens Energy Program, about the damage we can expect and the paths of resistance we can take to slow down the Trump administration's centrifuge of deregulation. Tyson, welcome to Locus Focus.
Hey, great to be here.
So do you think there'll be an EPA now that Scott Pruitt is the head of it?
Well, you know, he can't completely eradicate the agency, but he's definitely going to do all he can to dismantle a number of the important public health and public safety regulations that have been developed over the years. But at the end of the day, you have to remember that every regulation that the EPA puts together and enforces has an existing federal statute as its underlying authority. And so unless Trump and Congress dismantle the existing Clean Air Act and Clean Water Act, there are a number of things that advocacy groups and community groups to do to help ensure that the EPA does its job.
Well, this morning before I left, I saw an email that was a link to a news story, and the headline is, Scott Pruitt makes it clear that the Clean Power Plan is going away. So do you have any sense of what he means by that?
Right. So the Clean Power Plan was the proposal by the Obama administration to regulate greenhouse gas emissions from existing power plants, primarily coal-fired power plants. And this proposal by the Obama administration stems from a 2007 Supreme Court decision, a case called Massachusetts versus EPA, where the John Roberts Court, in a 5-4 decision, ruled that the EPA must regulate greenhouse gas emissions under its existing Clean Air Act authority if they found that there was a scientific reason that greenhouse gas emissions were causing climate change. So, and that's what's known as an endangerment finding. And that's what the EPA does, an endangerment finding, to determine whether or not something is a pollutant that is that needs to be regulated by the EPA. And this is very important. During his confirmation hearings, Scott Pruitt was asked, you know, look, we understand that you, Scott Pruitt, want to dismantle regulations. What are you going to do about the EPA's endangerment finding on greenhouse gas emissions? And Scott Pruitt said, I don't see any reason to revisit that, meaning that Scott Pruitt is not going to make any attempt to have the EPA walk away from or discredit the scientific analysis that the agency used to determine that greenhouse gas emissions are in fact a pollutant and are in fact causing global climate change. And that's because Scott Pruitt basically admitted that the science is overwhelming and compelling that greenhouse gas emissions are in fact causing climate change. So the fact that he was forced to admit that he wouldn't address that endangerment finding, that he wouldn't try to undermine it or erode it, that's very important. And there is a number of provisions within the Clean Air Act that allow for citizen groups, for community organizations to file lawsuits to say the EPA isn't doing a good enough job protecting the public health, and you can sue to try and force the EPA to do its job. And so these so-called citizen lawsuits have been an incredibly important feature in you know, with the EPA over the years. And so it's going to be very challenging. Pruitt and Trump have the upper hand in that they can take unilateral steps that are going to weaken EPA regulations, but there are opportunities for citizen groups, for environmental groups to try and stop that.
Well, what really got me in the article, in this Wall Street Journal interview that Pruitt did on Friday, he said that he expects to quickly withdraw both the Clean Power Plan and the Waters of the United States rule, the Obama administration's attempts at clarifying the EPA's regulatory authority under the Clean Water Act. So what does that mean, do you think?
So the Waters of the United States rule was a proposal under the Obama administration to significantly broaden the application of EPA authority over more types of water jurisdictions, to basically broaden the definition of what a navigable water resource is, because the federal government obviously is going to have jurisdiction over interstate water systems. So this was an effort to try and expand EPA authority, rightfully so. And, you know, you're going to see, Scott Pruitt walk that back. This doesn't end EPA regulation of the Clean Water Act. It doesn't end existing regulations. So, again, the ability of Scott Pruitt to undo existing regulations that are already in place is actually very limited. With the Clean Power Plan, it was a regulation that was proposed and finalized but not yet implemented, because last year the Supreme Court, just before Justice Scalia passed away, issued a stay on Obama's Clean Power Plan, and that stay meant that the agency couldn't proceed ahead until legal challenges were considered. And so the D.C. Court of Appeals is set to issue its decision on the legality of Obama's Clean Power Plan, you know, any day now.
Well, it seemed from the article that Pruitt was thinking about just yanking the law, the rule, before the court decision even comes down.
Right. Well, you know, Scott Pruitt and Donald Trump are challenged when it comes to facts and what they're able to do. The EPA cannot just unilaterally withdraw a rule that is under active consideration by a group of justices in the federal appeals court. Those justices are not going to look kindly upon that type of action. Pruitt has to wait until the federal court issues its decision. And the federal court can issue a decision in two broad ways. One, they can say, hey, this Obama Clean Power Plan proposal is great. It complies with the Constitution. It complies with the Federal Clean Air Act. And so we consider this to be a lawful regulation. In that case, the Trump administration cannot just unilaterally withdraw that. They would have to appeal that decision to the Supreme Court. Second, if the court finds that there are elements of the Clean Power Plan that do not comply with federal law, that they would then send the regulation back to the EPA for revision. In that case, yes, it's true, Pruitt could withdraw the rule in its entirety and just simply slow walk writing a new rule. He could take years to write a new rule with the intention of, you know, not doing anything. But Pruitt is limited. He cannot just unilaterally walk away from the Clean Power Plan because it is under active review and consideration by the federal judiciary.
Well, actually, one concern that I have in terms of whether the Trump administration would actually follow the rules and follow the law is looking at what happened with the Dakota Access Pipeline, and that there was an environmental impact statement process in place that the Obama administration and the Army Corps of Engineers had instituted just before the end of last year. And basically, when Trump said we're going to build the Dakota Access Pipeline, you know, anyway, the Army Corps of Engineers reversed itself and basically violated what appears to me to be federal law in terms of the...
This is actually not accurate. What the Army Corps of Engineers, remember, had already completed its environmental impact statement and had approved the pipeline under the Obama administration. What then, after the protests, the Obama administration directed the Army Corps of Engineers to reconsider and reassess whether or not all federal statutes, not just clean water laws, but there's a number of different statutes, the Antiquities Act and other acts that directly relate to Native American tribal rights, and directed the Army Corps to basically double check and make sure that it had followed all applicable regulations. That did not trigger a new full-on environmental impact statement. If they had, it would have been subject to public notice. You would have had to have required a public comment period, and that could have taken several years, right? That's not what the Obama administration did, right? The Obama administration waited very, very late in the game to take action to slow down and stop the Dakota Access Pipeline situation. So they did not trigger a full environmental review period. And so that's why the Trump administration can, in fact, simply undo the decision that the Obama administration did. You're not going to see any sort of legal challenge that's going to be at all successful on what the Trump administration has done, because the Trump administration was within its legal right. This is really the fault of the Obama administration for not doing enough aggressive action earlier in the process. They waited too long to raise these procedural challenges to the Dakota Access Pipeline.
So you see a big difference there between that and what you think are ways that Scott Pruitt won't have the same kind of high-handedness in terms of drilling with the Clean Power Act and the rest of his portfolio at the EPA.
Right. And also remember that the EPA wasn't really involved in the Dakota Access Pipeline issue. That was the Army Corps of Engineers, which is technically under the jurisdiction of the U.S. Department of Army, because it was Army Corps of Engineer land that the pipeline is going to go under. It's under the Missouri River at a place called Lake Oahe, which is a Army Corps of Engineer jurisdictional dam that was built in 1962. So the EPA really didn't have any review authority for that particular pipeline project.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tyson Slocum, who's director of Public Citizens Energy Program. We're talking about the implications of having Scott Pruitt now as the head of the EPA. For listeners who have not been closely following who Scott Pruitt is, I thought we should do a little bit of background and who is this guy and why was there so much opposition to his nomination to head the EPA?
Right. So Scott Pruitt was the Republican Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma. And in that capacity, he developed a reputation for doing favors on behalf of the oil and gas industry, which was very powerful within Oklahoma. And in a number of instances, he repeatedly sided with the oil and gas industry against farmers, landowners, and people concerned about clean air and clean water in the state. And because of a number of Open Records Act documents that were obtained through requests by the New York Times and some other organizations, including the Center for Media and Democracy, we found clear evidence in the form of email communications and other types of documentation where Scott Pruitt, as Attorney General, solicited direct feedback from lobbyists representing big oil and gas industry in Oklahoma and said, listen, we're thinking about taking a position on this lawsuit. We're thinking about submitting a legal brief. You know, what is your take on this issue? And in a number of instances, the oil and gas industry lobbyists, with their attorneys, put together a proposed legal brief or a petition, gave it to Scott Pruitt. Scott Pruitt, in turn, maybe changed a word or two and adopted almost in full these legal briefs, these other documents that were submitted by the oil and gas industry, and submitted them on official Oklahoma Attorney General letterhead as official submissions by the Attorney General. And so what the email and other document records clearly show is that Scott Pruitt, time and time again for years, when he was contemplating what official actions to take as Attorney General, he turned to the oil and gas industry for legal advice and adopted many of their proposals as is. And so that just demonstrates a extremely disturbing trend. And in fact, we issued a call to the Senate last week asking them to delay the confirmation vote on Scott Pruitt until the latest batch of hundreds of emails and other documents were released and time was granted to the Senate to fully digest all of these documents. And unfortunately, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell ignored that and rushed through the vote before the public and the Senate had all of the facts at our disposal to determine just how in the pocket of big oil Scott Pruitt has been.
Well, now that the judge has ordered that the documents be released, and I understand they can be released tomorrow, or they're supposed to be released by tomorrow.
That's correct.
What will happen if there is really incriminating evidence and showing a clear conflict of interest in those documents?
Well, we can use that to try and create a controversy that this man is unfit to hold the office. And there might be potential lawsuits that could be filed that would target him personally from his capacity of as Attorney General of Oklahoma. He's still, if he violated any laws or anything while he was Attorney General, he is still liable for that. So there are ways to generate real controversy and scandal about depending upon what's in these documents that an Oklahoma judge demanded that they be released to the public.
Do you have any idea what is in those documents?
I don't know, but if it's from the smaller sample size that we've already seen from several years ago, like I said, those documents show clear coordination between Scott Pruitt and oil and gas lobbyists on setting official Oklahoma state policy. So I would imagine we're going to see more of the same. And the question is, after we get these documents and have a chance to look at them, we're going to try and determine whether or not Scott Pruitt violated any laws while he was Attorney General. And if he did, then obviously that's going to be a big push to get him to resign as EPA head or get the Congress to intervene.
So was there any evidence or suggestion in the documents that were already released that there is a likelihood that he violated some laws?
I'm not sure. I mean, unfortunately, Oklahoma laws aren't incredibly robust on this issue, and it doesn't appear as though there's any legal violation to, getting recommended policy and legal positions from the oil and gas industry. The issue is whether or not there was any clear exchange, hey, oil and gas industry, maybe you guys should come to my fundraiser coming up next week and make sure that your CEOs and your corporate political action committees give generously to my reelection efforts or, another point, Scott Pruitt chaired the National Republican Attorney General Association, which was the national association of all the state attorney generals that were Republican. So, and in that capacity, Scott Pruitt oversaw their fundraising activities that solicited money from corporations. So that's going to be the key, is there any connection between the corporations seeking and obtaining favors from Scott Pruitt and any solicitations from Pruitt or any of his close associates for money from these same industries. And so that's something that we'll be looking for.
Well, another potential conflict of interest that I could see is he sued the EPA as Attorney General of Oklahoma 14 times. Many of those lawsuits are still pending. So, and he's refused to recuse himself. Is that, no, I mean, I get him confused with Jeff Sessions, so I retract that one. But isn't
right.
there
so,
an
so
issue
he's
there?
He's going to have to recuse himself from anything that he's, you know, where he's a party to litigation against the EPA. So it's true that he was a very active litigant against the EPA. And so, you know, that was another argument against him is, you know, he has sued the EPA so many times, that's going to force his recusal on so many different issues that he might not be able to effectively lead the EPA because he's going to be officially recused from a number of different proceedings.
So he will have to be recused, unlike Jeff Sessions, who is refusing to recuse himself for situations where he's obviously in a conflict.
That appears to be the case, yes.
I wonder why that is. So a few little glimmers of hope. So let's talk about the strategy that you at Public Citizen and other not just environmental groups, but all kinds of human rights groups and social justice groups are going to be taking to deal with the onslaught against regulation and the whole mission of the EPA. Since here we have somebody who obviously his whole career has been set up to be at odds, to oppose the EPA and everything that it represents, or at least the EPA of the last 8 years.
Right. So, you know, we just put out another release today. We at Public Citizen, and for those listeners with internet access, we're at citizen.org. And what we're calling this is the corporate cabinet, because this is an unprecedented number of either former high-ranking corporate officials or individuals with very clear and deep corporate ties, Scott Pruitt being one of them. But he's not the only one. You've got Rex Tillerson, the former CEO of ExxonMobil, who is our Secretary of State now. And we raise significant problems with the inherent conflicts of interest that Mr. Tillerson poses. You've got Ryan Zinke, who has been confirmed to be has been nominated to be the Secretary of Interior, and the Secretary of Interior is actually a very important agency when it comes to climate change, because 40% of all of U.S. coal production comes from federal land under the jurisdiction of the Department of Interior. 21% of America's record oil production comes from land owned by the American people under the Department of Interior, and 16% of all the natural gas that America produces, and remember, America is the largest natural gas producer on the planet, comes from Department of Interior land. So regulations and policies that the Department of Interior sets has a huge impact on coal, oil, and natural gas production. And we've raised a number of concerns with the nomination of Ryan Zinke to be head of Interior. Rick Perry, former governor of the state of Texas, with very deep ties to the oil and gas industry, he's been slated to head up the Department of Energy. These are kind of the big four on energy and climate issues: Tillerson at State, Pruitt at EPA, Zinke at Interior, and Perry at Energy. That really are distressing if you care about clean water, clean air, promotion of clean energy, and concerns about climate change.
Well, this coming week is the big week to organize, to meet and in some cases confront your elected officials during the congressional recess. Do you know or see actions where the members of Congress will be confronted directly by the constituents to deal with these issues, these conflicts, and other kind of outrageous developments that are happening within the Trump administration?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that there's a ton of actions going on all over the place, and I think folks in Oregon can tap into those and make sure that you're aware of, you know, where your members of Congress are going to be in your local district, and make sure to turn out and to confront them on what their positions are on some of these nominees and on policies of the very radical Trump administration. You know, Trump has no mandate whatsoever to be governing in this type of corporate raider style. He lost the popular election by a wide margin, and his approval ratings are the lowest of any president in the first month of his presidency in American history. This is a deeply unpopular president who has very little support for his radical agenda, and it's absolutely imperative that the American people continue to make that known loudly and often.
Well, a concern that I have, I keep reading articles over the last few days about how, while the mainstream media and people like us are very aware of Trump's frailties, the chaos in his administration, his unpopularity, that within the world of Trump, as represented at that rally he had Saturday in Florida, all 9,000 supporters that were there, which, by the way, seemed to me to be a small amount compared to how many people in Florida protested during the Women's March. But at any rate,
right,
he was surrounded by this echo chamber of 9,000 diehard supporters who believe he's right. And the Trump administration, whether they believe they're right or whether this is just good PR spin, it doesn't seem like they are being affected very much yet by all the protest and all the broadcasting of their ineptitude, of their potential their corruption and their potential criminal violations.
Oh, I think they're definitely being affected by it. I mean, Donald Trump has very thin skin. He watches cable television. He reads the newspaper. I hope that he's listening to KBOO right now.
I'm sure he is. Be. I'm not actually sure he reads the newspaper, actually. I think he watches Fox News mainly.
Right. So he is extremely aware, and all you have to do is read his tweets to see how unhinged and deranged he becomes at any sort of criticism. He hears all the criticism, and he reacts in very volatile and bizarre ways. And you've already seen some of the criticism result in a withdrawal of some of his picks to run the National Security Agency, for example.
That's actually a very interesting thing, that this guy, Harwood, that they were thinking, oh, he's in. And he says, sorry, I don't want the job. And I just think that whole thing is playing out right now is showing, I mean, it's interesting and perhaps particularly frightening that's happening in the security department of his administration. So you look at it, there's no national security functioning right now in this country. But I mean, I'm just as concerned about what's happening in the environmental factors and the human services factors of the United of the country. Do you see that what's going on? Let's use the whole example of Michael Flynn and the fact that Trump is unable to find somebody to fill that job now. What does that reflect to you about what is really going on within the administration?
Well, I see a high level of dysfunction. I see the constant attacks by reputable media companies that are simply reporting the facts of how radical and out of control some of the Trump administration proposals have been, everything from the Muslim ban to ordering government officials to remove any sort of mention of climate change, all of these things that are completely unprecedented, completely unsupported by the facts. I think it's having an effect of creating confusion and dysfunction within the highest levels of the Trump administration. These are people that were not prepared to govern, that had very little experience governing. You're seeing more infighting within the administration. And so we've got to keep the fact gathering and the criticisms up, because they are indeed having an effect. There are parts of the Trump administration that are grinding to a halt because he can't recruit people, because reasonable thinking people don't want to be a part of this radical travesty that's called the Trump administration. And so, you know, here at Public Citizen, we're just calling it the way we see it. This is a out of control corporate cabinet dominated by special interests, a conflict of interests, where it appears as though there's a number of high-level Trump administration officials that are intent on carrying out favors for companies that they are directly tied with or have close relations with, and that is just massive conflict of interest. And so we're just going to keep the pressure on.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Tyson Slocum, who's director of Public Citizen's Energy Program. We've been talking particularly about the appointment of Scott Pruitt to head the EPA and what that means. And in the last part of the show, I'd like to talk about what do you see is your strategy and the strategy of the rest of the country that believes that there's such a thing as climate change induced by human activity, to move ahead in the face of Scott Pruitt, at least at this point, being the head of the EPA. What's your strategy to stop as much as possible from what his agenda would be?
Well, I think one thing we have to acknowledge is that it's going to be tough to stop the transition that's already well underway within our economy towards green energy. The Trump administration can't do a whole lot to make renewable energy more expensive than coal, because right now renewable energy is cheaper than coal, and that's why coal has been dying a slow death in this country. It's not necessarily because of EPA regulations, it's because it's losing in the marketplace. And so I see the deployable superior technology of renewable energy, of rooftop solar, of utility scale wind, of continued advancements in energy efficiency, in the electrification of the transportation sector, of energy storage in the form of high-performance batteries that are being developed here in the United States. All of these things combined are what the future and soon-to-be current state of America's energy system, that's what it's going to look like. And so Donald Trump can talk about oil and fracking and coal all he wants, but he's not going to be able to stop the progress that we're seeing in clean energy. And second, we just need to continue to highlight the corruption, the conflicts of interest, the corporate ties of key decision makers in the Trump administration as they try and change policies and make proposed changes to important statutes like the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act, that we have to understand what's motivating these people. And it's a desire to benefit their corporate masters and making sure that we don't have major decisions being made by the Trump administration that benefit their corporate benefactors.
So how do we make sure that that happens?
Well, you know, just continuing to expose the truth, to work with reputable news sources, to talk to folks like KBOO Radio, and make sure that the public are getting the real facts and not alternative facts.
Or fake news.
Right, exactly.
Actually, I just was remembering as we were talking, I saw this headline today in The Guardian, and it's "The Wild West of Wind. Republicans push Texas as unlikely green energy leader." And I thought that kind of reinforces what you were just saying. Are you aware of that article and sort of this interesting direction that, in fact, Rick Perry, who is Mr. Oil and Gas, as far as you can imagine, is also Mr. Wind Power?
Right, because Texas has, I believe, the largest installed wind capacity of any state in the United States. And that's really market-driven. It's driven because wind power is such a superior energy production resource. It's fairly inexpensive to build, and once you have it built, the fuel cost is zero, right? Nope, nobody owns patent rights over the wind, not yet anyway. So wind power has seen tremendous gains in Texas, and so as part of that, Rick Perry ended up supporting it because it was a major business investment. I think that's important to highlight, where Renewables aren't as entrenched in Republican Party corporate connections, but there's no question that now more people in the United States are employed directly by the solar industry than by the coal industry. That's significant, and we're only going to see those numbers accelerate, that as we transition away from fossil fuels and towards renewable energy, we're going to see economic and job gains from that. The question is the federal government going to take actions to facilitate and accelerate that transition, or are they going to try to erect roadblocks that would delay that transition? And that's what we've got to stop them from doing.
Yeah, it seems like a whole lot of it has to do with financial and tax incentives and things like the, I guess there's a wind tax credit.
Yes, a wind production tax credit.
Right, and it's always like only, it's renewed every couple of years or something. So it's not a very stable tax credit, and therefore it has the potential to undermine the continuing growth of the wind industry.
Right, but I mean, the production tax credit helps, but at this point, it's kind of icing on the cake. The wind industry would be able to continue to outcompete coal with or without the production tax credit. I think some of the more important things are actually more state-level subsidies, particularly for rooftop solar. You've had a number of states debate something known as net metering. That's a payment that is made to a household or a commercial business for generating electric power from rooftop solar. And there's been a number of initiatives at the state level to remove or significantly reduce the financial value of producing electricity from your rooftop solar. And that's, you know, the monopoly fossil fuel utilities have been the ones attacking those solar tariffs. So that actually is very important because, if you make an investment in rooftop solar, you ought to get paid for it. Net metering is a very sensible approach to making sure that owners of rooftop systems are paid for the benefits that they produce to the grid. And so there's a big movement, by utilities to try and stop the growth of rooftop solar.
Well, I want to get back to something you said earlier in the show, which was interesting, that during Scott Pruitt's confirmation hearings, he basically acknowledged that climate change is real. Is that your take on it? And do you think that's going to...
I mean, what he acknowledged is that he cannot try and undo the EPA's endangerment finding that determined with a scientific basis that climate change is real and that it's caused by the man-made consumption of fossil fuels, of burning of fossil fuels for energy. So Scott Pruitt came right out and said, no, I'm not going to undo the endangerment finding. And that's because he can't, because that was argued in a court of law. There was a Republican judge in the D.C. Court of Appeals, David Santel, who was appointed by Reagan, who oversaw the case that was brought by the coal industry against the EPA on the endangerment finding. So there was a federal case in the federal appeals court that centered on the scientific debate of climate change. And this Republican-led panel of judges in the D.C. Court of Appeals ruled unanimously that the EPA had overwhelmingly made the scientific case that climate change was real, and that therefore greenhouse gas emissions are a pollutant that needed to be regulated. So what Scott Pruitt acknowledged is he can't undo those legally endorsed facts of the science of climate change. So that is significant. Now what he can do is try and slow the operations of the EPA down to a standstill where they will be extremely slow to do anything about this problem of climate change. But the underlying statute and the underlying factual assessment of climate change is something that even an oil and gas guy like Scott Pruitt can't undo.
Well, it's really good talking with you, Tyson, and maybe we can talk again in a few months when Scott Pruitt is up on corruption charges and we're looking at possible new controversies in the Trump administration.
I'd be happy to.
Okay, well, thanks a whole lot for joining us.
All right, you got it.
We've been talking with Tyson Slocum, who's director of Public Citizens Energy Program, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper returns to Locus Focus to give us an update on the struggles to keep the Northwest future fossil fuel free. My engineer is Derek Crooks. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go with some music by Steve Earle. Thanks for listening.